TexasObserver.org. You're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing things and say things to you on the radio instead. This week, we've got Observer Associate Editor Forrest Wilder on the show. Welcome, Forrest.
Hey, Jonathan. How you doing?
Pretty good. Also with us is politics writer Christopher Hooks. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Jonathan.
Later in the show, we'll be joined by Observer staff writer Emily DePrang and freelance writer Beth Cortez-Nevel to talk about the foster care system in Texas. 14 children died from abuse or neglect while in Texas' custody last year. Reforms are underway to improve the foster care system, but some folks are concerned that they may actually make things worse. But before we get to that, we've got a lot of news to discuss. The primary runoff elections went down earlier this week. Gents, I want your take on what went down on Tuesday night. But first, I want to mention, just in passing, that the voter turnout numbers were pretty low. I don't think I'm going to surprise anybody when I say that they were pretty low. Just how low? According to the Secretary of State's website, 13.6 million registered voters in Texas. Of those, 951,461, or about 5%, did their civic duty for Tuesday's runoff elections. That said, let's talk about what they actually decided. And I think we should start with the contentious race for the GOP nominee for lieutenant governor between incumbent David Dewhurst and Senator Dan Patrick. Gents, what do you think about this?
The people have spoken, or 5% of the eligible voters, or about 2% of everybody lives in the state.
Right.
They've spoken, and they have said bye-bye, David Dewhurst. It's the end of the line for him. He went out with, I would describe it technical terms, a swift kick in the pants.
Mm-hmm.
He lost, I think it's a landslide when you say 65-35. Dan Patrick took him out, was not even close. It is a huge triumph for Dan Patrick, that's for sure.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed not even close pretty much from the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, in the home stretch, certainly the question was just probably how bad is David Dewhurst going to get beaten. And it's kind of, in a way, it's a replay of his run against Ted Cruz,
mm-hmm.
In which, you know, he tried to get to the right of his opponent and couldn't do that. One, because he's not a very effective politician, and two, I don't really think that's who he was. And so, you know, the GOP base voters, you can say what you want about them, but I feel like they can sniff out inauthenticity pretty well. They have good BS detectors when it comes to that. You know, Dan Patrick, when he came into the Senate in 2006, he was a marginal figure. I mean, his colleagues, both Democrats and Republicans, laughed at him. He was a joke. He came in, he wanted to do away with the two-thirds rule. They put that to a vote. He lost 30-1,
right?
I believe was the vote. He was the one. You know, he came in talking about a revolution and was broadcasting his radio show. And, you know, I think that the Austin establishment, whatever that is, thought that, you know, his career would be short and not very sweet. And now he's arguably will be the most powerful figure in Texas if he wins in November against the Democrat Leticia Vandeput.
Yeah, the last decade of his career has been amazing, you have to put some of that to him. He's a much more effective and capable political operator than anyone thought, clearly, when he came into the Senate in 2006. It's amazing how, after how long we've been talking about this race, the better part of a year, it seems like that how quickly it came to an end. I could be wrong, but I think it was the first major race called that night. It was called pretty quickly by the Tribune, at least after the first results came out. Yeah, and it also seems like, David Dewhurst really underperformed other statewide Republicans on the ticket. Someone like Tommy Merritt, has not been in many headlines recently, running for agriculture commissioner, got, I think, nearly 45% of the vote, and David Dewhurst was 10 points under. It was really a stomping.
I mean, despite all the pandering, you know, going to the Tea Party, every little Tea Party group in the state, you know, sitting in living rooms, the five people taking notes about Agenda 21 and C-Scope, despite, you know, in the legislative session, basically being the prime mover, at least initially, behind the anti-abortion legislation, which I don't ever remember that being a David Dewhurst priority. I mean, he did what you would think would be expected of him. But the fact is, the way that the Republican Party in Texas works right now is, and this goes beyond just the Dewhurst-Patrick race, but the Republican Party right now in the state of Texas is the Tea Party. I mean, it was such a huge triumph for the Tea Party on Tuesday. The rest of the country, we see all these headlines, you know, the marquee candidates are just, you know, flaming out. Political analysts and journalists basically think the Tea Party has peaked nationally. In Texas, we have ever higher high water marks. And I think Tuesday, you know, that was the transformation. We're now in a spot where they are in control. The old school conservative, by the way, still very conservative, but not conservative enough. Republicans are, fading.
You guys talk about this a little bit in the piece that you wrote during our coverage of the events on Tuesday. You talked about how Dewhurst and his ilk kind of represent this version of the GOP party where, they were around when the one party system in Texas was kind of like new and emerging. And now you've got people like Dan Patrick and they've only known that.
Well, I mean, the fight is between, I mean, the joke is there's two parties in Texas. There's the Republican Party and there's a Tea Party.
Right.
And that's what the fight is. I mean, Democrats are sort of, minority party at best, if not just kind of irrelevant. But remember Rick Perry was a Democrat. A lot of these guys that, 5 years ago were standard bearers in Texas and even nationally for conservative Republicanism have now been outflanked. I mean, I think one of the races that we were talking about a lot, and we'll have a piece out, is about a state senator from East Texas, Bob Dool. He mm-hmm. was elected in 2002. When he came in, he was considered a crazy conservative, right? He's a doctor who was against abortion in all cases, even cases of rape and incest, which was considered like on the conservative fringe when he came in. Well, he lost on Tuesday mm-hmm. because he was, quote unquote, liberal.
Right. Not conservative enough.
And he was beat by a guy who was the president of a local Tea Party, who basically went around and said, Bob Dool is way too conservative for us, and we need to get a true constitutional conservative in. And it worked. This is a guy, his name's Bob Hall. He just moved to Texas 5 years ago. You know, hasn't even been around that long in the state. Talks about Agenda 21, talks about C-Scope, the mm-hmm. school curriculum is a communist indoctrination plan. Thinks bicycle paths are part of a UN conspiracy. I mean, these are the type of folks that are getting elected because they're to the right, to the satisfaction of the base.
Right.
I mean, that's one thing that's amazing about many of the candidates that were selected on Tuesday is you might think in another situation that a one-party state would be a situation in which kind of the cream rises to the top, and that the competition within the party means that the best candidates are vying to run with the Republicans, you know. But many of the people that were selected on Tuesday are these people that are kind of compromised in this strange way. There's Bob Hall. The attorney general candidate Ken Paxton is someone who
broke the law and is going to be the top law enforcer in the state. Now.
Yeah, there's a small chance that he might be disbarred or charged with a felony in the course of the general election. There's other people like Sid Miller, the nominee for agriculture commissioner, is a guy who has Ted Nugent as his campaign treasurer. He's just kind of like walking.
Has had campaign finance problems.
Yeah,
alleged that he was exercising his horse by basically almost dragging it behind a trailer. I mean, and I think the thing is that even if you think that Texas is a red state, which by all evidence at this point in time it is, if you think that Texas is conservative, which by all evidence it is, even still, these characters we're just breaking new kind of boundaries on the right. We're just pushing it farther and farther and farther. And the thing is that there doesn't seem to be a counterbalance. For a while, it was basically, your country club Republicans, your mainstream Republicans, your business interests that would kind of provide a counterbalance, or maybe, maybe an occasional Democrat, but the Democratic Party is just kind of moribund. Mm-hmm. And it appears that the business wing is kind of in trouble too, of the Republican Party. So there's just not a counterbalance here. All the momentum is right. And it's kind of hard to see where this goes.
And for the last couple of elections, you'd be used to hearing people say, well, things are moving to the right, but there really is a way in which this is where we aren't breaking new ground with this.
It's a quantum leap.
Since Rick Perry has been in office since 2000, the top position in kind of the state political hierarchy, there's been an absence of turnover. And in a way, the state has kind of been in stasis since the early 2000s. So there's a lot of, on the conservative wing, there's been a kind of a lot of pent-up frustration and a desire to get new people in. And they really haven't had the opportunity to do that in a lot of spots until now.
So should we talk about the Democrats real quick?
Yeah, actually, I wanted to ask you, do we have to? I wanted to ask you about Jim Hogan. Can you tell us a little bit about him? I know you talked to
Hogan's
him.
Hogan's Heroes. Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, one wag on Twitter, a Democratic consultant guy, said this was the saddest ballot he'd ever seen for the Democrats. and really, it was really sad. I mean, basically, the two, you know, quote unquote, big races were between Kesha Rogers, who is a LaRouche Democrat who wants to impeach Obama and likes to paint Hitler mustaches on Obama and wants to colonize and mine the moon, okay?
Helium-3, man. We need that helium-3.
She somehow made it into the runoff with David Alamiel, who's a wealthy dentist and is the party's pick and is a mainstream candidate. Now, Alamiel did, you know, demolish Rogers, you know, I think it was 75% on his side. The other race, though, was for ag commissioner between Kinky Friedman,
yeah,
who, you know, a lot of Democrats really can't stand because he seems like an opportunist, who was running on a marijuana legalization platform, and a guy named Jim Hogan. Who is Jim Hogan, Chris?
Jim Hogan is a dairy farmer from Cleburne who has never raised any money, never campaigned, and had his outreach efforts run as far, I guess, as his public library computer card, right?
That's right. Real nice guy. I've talked to him on the phone a couple times. You know, I don't know if he's a Democrat. He really won't say. You know, he thinks that's not important. The voters don't care, which is a funny thing to say when you're running in a Democratic primary.
Sure.
But he won, okay? Yeah. And his platform is basically, I don't campaign. You know, he's been
the Zen platform. You platform by not platforming.
I think he's got the last laugh.
Yeah.
He won. You know, all the media and everybody were making fun of him, and like the party was embarrassed by him. And he is the general election nominee. I asked him if he was going to debate Sid Miller, of the Ted Nugent fame, and a former state rep. And he said, no, I don't do debates. I got too many ahs and ain'ts. I'm a farmer. I'm not a debater.
Right.
So
I think he said he wasn't even watching the election returns that night, right? He was with his neighbor making stew.
Country boy stew.
Yeah.
Which somebody got a recipe for, and it's got hamburger meat in it, and it sounded pretty good.
But nice. Yeah.
But not only did he beat Kinky Friedman, he also beat the party's choice in the original primary.
Right.
He, a guy that the party actually kind of would have wanted to win, a guy named Hugh Fitzsimmons. Yeah.
Who's a bison farmer, sits on a groundwater district. Seemed like the type of choice the party would want, right? He lost in the first round.
And obviously for the Democrats, the top two races are for governor and lieutenant governor, Wendy Davis and Letitia Vandepute. But having all of these kind of stiffs up and down the ballot is not good for people. If you're trying to get people energized and excited about it.
I mean, does Jim Hogan go to the convention? Do they have him on stage? And does he give a speech? Does he appear with Wendy Davis? I don't know. You know, it doesn't really matter, but it's just this is what happens when you have a party that can't even field decent candidates down the ballot. Think about this. We go back to Ken Paxton, who's the Republican nominee for attorney general. Like we were saying earlier, this is a guy who broke the law and was fined for it by the state securities board. Won this, you know, he's going on the ballot for November. Who do the Democrats have?
A lawyer named Sam Houston.
Right. Who is a perennial candidate whose main attraction appears to be his name. You know, not a knock on Sam Houston, except that, you know, how many times do you run and lose before maybe, you know, you step down and let somebody else run, or the party recruits somebody who has a chance? But again, it's the classic catch-22 for the Texas Democratic Party. You can't attract good candidates unless they have a chance in hell of winning. Okay, Letitia Vandepute and Wendy Davis aside for a second. You can't do that until you actually win. And to win, you need a good candidate.
Right.
So it's a bit of a conundrum they're in. I think that, like, you know, the way out is for Wendy Davis or Letitia Vandepute to win, or at least do much better than other Democrats have done in previous cycles.
Well, guys, I'd love to keep talking about this, and I'm sure we will in future episodes. But for now, we're out of time. So I'm going to thank you for coming by and giving us the rundown.
Thanks.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. In their story in the Observer's June issue, staff writer Emily DePrang and freelance writer Beth Cortez-Neville discuss Texas's foster care system, a system in which 14 children died of abuse or neglect last year. The piece goes on to talk about reforms that would privatize the foster care system, a move some say might actually make things worse. Emily and Beth are here with us to talk about this very important issue. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks.
Sure.
Also with us is Catherine Barrias, an expert on foster care privatization. Good to have you here, Catherine.
Good to be here.
For starters, Beth and Emily, do you mind giving us a sort of brief gist of your story? And I guess which one of you would like to go first?
I can go.
Okay.
Yeah. So basically, we wanted to look at the current problems in the system with a focus on child safety, because as you mentioned, there were 14 child deaths from child abuse and neglect for kids that were in the system at the time. And then we also wanted to take a look at the new reforms that the state is implementing, because we felt that they're not being accurately looked at in the media right now. So that's about the gist of that.
Right on. And the person who sort of you've picked to help tell this story is a woman named Crystal Bentley. Can you guys tell me a little bit about her?
Yeah, this is Emily. Crystal is an alumnus of the foster care system. So she's been in it since she was four. She was adopted at 11, but ended up back in a residential treatment facility. So she was really raised in the foster care system in Texas. And frankly, her childhood was a nightmare. And her story illustrates that even though we get a lot of media attention directed at those tragedies when a child actually dies, there are unknown children that are experiencing other horrors and longer, I mean, just lifetimes, I mean, entire childhoods of nightmarish circumstances. Not all, obviously, but they definitely exist, and we actually heard from several of them. We just focused on one.
And are these conditions what sparked the reform movement to happen?
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Beth.
Oh, sorry. So the deaths are the most horrific, tangible thing that the media has grabbed onto. And so actually way back in 2004, there was also a high number of child deaths of kids that were in the foster care system. I think it was 14 or 15. I can't remember. I get the numbers mixed up between 2004 and 2005. But Governor Rick Perry wanted to reform the system then. And so in 2005, there was a bill passed to reform the system. And they wanted to privatize the system then also. And unlike this time, because the new reforms are basically privatizing the system, they wanted to privatize case management. And so we're not doing that this time, but back in 2004, they wanted to do that. And then in 2006, there were another number of child deaths from kids that were in private agencies, and we halted the privatization process. And then it came back up in 2011. And so now we have this privatization that's happening again, and we seem to have this selective memory about the reasons why we stopped it in the first place.
Well, the thing is that we've never actually, I mean, Texas has a partially privatized system mm-hmm. already, and we've never actually gone forward with additional privatization ever since that first push, but it kept coming up. But then in 2011, this foster care redesign, which for a long time nobody would even call privatization, came back to the fore and actually got passed. And I've, you know, heard several people speculate that the reason that they passed this was because something had to be done about these child deaths. And the question that we pose in the story is whether or not anything will actually, whether or not the problems that are most dire, including abuse and deaths, are actually going to be ameliorated, or whether conditions are going to get better due to these reforms. Now, Catherine Barrias is an expert in privatization of foster care systems, and she has some interesting things to say, Catherine, about the privatization efforts in foster care in other states.
Well, and actually to start with Texas, what a lot of people don't know and what, you know, the BFTS certainly hasn't mentioned in this process is that the first privatization effort or an extension of privatization was in 1998. The Texas legislature mandated a cost-neutral pilot project that established Lena Pope Homes Incorporated as a lead agency responsible for child placement and case management. And that agency was paid a flat daily rate per child and given a great deal of responsibility for case decision-making and the development of a service provider network, and essentially went way in the hole, I believe about $2 million, ironically, what Provident Service Corporation is currently saying is the deficit they're at.
And Provident Services Corporation is one of the lead contractors that the state has sort of put over a whole bunch of other people that are taking care of children.
Thanks, Beth.
Yes, they were the first awarded a contract to be the single source continuum contractor. They are a for-profit corporation that they have offices all over the United States.
Is it fair to say that this notion of keeping things cost neutral is unrealistic?
It is. You know, Emily brought up other states. No state that has attempted these efforts has been able to do it without an infusion of dollars, essentially state general revenue dollars. Some states have from the onset said that they are attempting privatization or reforming their system to save money as one of their goals. Texas certainly didn't say that, but you've really got to look at the expansion of what is required by an SSCC, by these lead agencies, that is so different and so far beyond what is currently required of our legacy system, which is what they refer to as the system that is, you know, primarily run by the state of Texas. So, you know, you're trying to get more bang for the same amount of buck, and that's just not possible in the system, particularly in social services, because it's hard to cost out. You don't know how much therapy a child or a parent is particularly going to need. That varies by case. So it's really hard to determine dollar amounts, but you can get general historical estimates on what things are going to cost, and it doesn't look like that worked out too well, at least in terms of what we're seeing from Providence's financial problems.
We've mentioned this in a previous episode where we talked about this issue, but I'm wondering if you can give us a more specific idea of what this extra bang for the buck might look like. I mean, what does that turn into in terms of goods and services?
Well, ideally, what you want is comprehensive wraparound services that impact not only the children in foster care and their biological parents, but the other people who are very important in their life. So that can be family members who will form a support system for the child and possibly their parents who may be taking care of that child. That could be teachers. It could be a community of people, to be honest. That is what an ideal service provision would look like. Mm-hmm. That is incredibly expensive because that involves not only direct services such as therapy and maybe psychotropic medications, it also involves transportation. It involves the time of the people who are supervising, you know, the children, whether it's making sure they're in extracurricular activities, getting them tutoring. So when you're talking about a child's well-being, especially a child who's been traumatized, the goods and services can become quite costly because there's rarely one solution to that complex of a case.
Emily, did you have something you wanted to add to that?
Oh, she did a great job of explaining what that is. Yeah, and one of the things that troubled me when I was learning about this was that these private companies that are coming in and agreeing that they can provide these services and develop these services even in rural areas and keep an eye on everybody at once, they didn't have to show how that was financially possible, how they were going to execute that, how they were going to afford it, or what they even expected it to cost. They just basically had to sign a contract saying that they would do it and that they could do it. And they are already one of the, like we mentioned, Providence, the for-profit company that has taken over this huge 60-county rural swath. They are already reporting that the CEO told Beth in an interview that they expected Texas to realize that it's going to cost more than they thought. And they testified that they were already providing services at a loss.
Do you think they were banking on the legislature, I don't know, showing them some additional dollars in the future?
If I'm going to speculate, I would imagine they must, because the CEO that spoke to Beth wasn't surprised. He said, well,
he wouldn't confirm.
So, well, we had heard a rumor, which is now actually, I think it was the Houston Chronicle reported that there were $2 million in the hole. But when I had asked him to directly, he wouldn't deny it and he wouldn't confirm that they were that dollar amount in. But he said, yes, that, you know, they were having problems with money, but that they were talking to the state about sort of reshuffling some of the money, I guess, to keep it cost neutral, but to take money out of somewhere else in the Health and Human Services Department so that they could sort of fund the services that they're trying to build in those counties. Because right now they don't have the appropriate services for the children that they're taking care of in the 60 counties that Providence is over. And they're trying to shift away from group home settings and build up more family settings and get more individual foster family homes. But the problem is they're trying to do that for kids who may need additional services, like Boreas mentioned, like therapy or other intensive services. And a lot of families aren't signing up for that job right now, and a lot of the kids usually go to group homes.
Well, and another, to piggyback off of Beth's point, one of the concerns we had before Providence ever signed the contract is, how are you going to create something out of nothing? And I mean, no disrespect to that part of the state, but if you take Odessa as an example, they're having trouble hiring CPS caseworkers there because the cost of housing is just astronomical. There is a scarcity of services, as Beth mentioned, a scarcity of families willing to or able to provide a home for these children.
Well, on that note, we're a little bit over, but I'd like to thank all of you guys for being on the show. Ms. Boreas, thank you very much. And, of course, Beth and Emily, always a pleasure to have you on.
Sure.
Thanks.
Thanks for coming, Catherine.
The story is Fostering Neglect. You can read it on texasobserver.org. We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music. And, of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, you can visit us on the web at texasobserver.org, or you can pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.